The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Kirk Apuellen.
Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the government's economic response to the COVID-19 pandemic?
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr Speaker, on Monday, international credit ratings agency Moody's released an in-depth analysis of New Zealand following its recent decision to reaffirm its highest AAA rating on the economy. Moody's said that New Zealand's low government debt puts us in a position to invest in infrastructure, housing, education and measures to support families. The report says that the lasting effects of COVID-19 will be more limited given the degree of policy response that the government has announced. Moody's added that, notwithstanding the significant disruptions stemming from the current economic shock, we expect the New Zealand economy to remain resilient in the face of shocks. Mr Speaker, I welcome this acknowledgement of our fiscal position and ability to invest in the country's recovery.
Supplementary, sir. What reactions has he seen from business to the government's economic response to the COVID-19 pandemic?
Mr Speaker, I've seen many reactions from businesses about the significant difference that the government's support measures have made for them during these difficult and uncertain times. I will just choose a couple of them. One small manufacturing business contacted the government saying, quote, "When faced with lockdown, our biggest worry was keeping and paying our staff. They are our biggest asset and we appreciate them all very much for their productivity and for making our workplace a happy place. So when the wage subsidy was announced, we were stunned and relieved. I cried when the money showed up in the account as we worked so hard to build this business up and the fear was real that we could lose everything that we had worked for." A small family-run transport firm said, "We'd like to thank the government for in some instances being willing to signal direction before a solution is in place. An example of this has proved very helpful was the early notification of the wage subsidy for essential workers who are stood down because of being vulnerable, ill or looking after a vulnerable family. Because we knew that that undertaking had been made to work, we had confidence to support these workers." Mr Speaker, there are many different experiences for business and I acknowledge that not all of them are satisfied with the government's response, but we believe we are doing everything we can to cushion the blow of COVID-19.
Supplementary, sir. How will the government continue to support the economy to recover from the effects of COVID-19?
We've always said that the measures we have put in place thus far are only the beginning of the government's commitment to support the economy and the people of New Zealand. We have been and will continue to be adaptable in our approach and to suit the situation as it unfolds. Over the coming weeks, we will see the budget and further explanation of the three waves of response that we have. I can assure New Zealanders that we will continue to provide further support for businesses and households as we look ahead. We will kickstart the recovery and we will rebuild the economy on a sustainable path for the long term.
Question number two, the Leader of the Opposition.
Speaker, to the Prime Minister. Does she stand by all her government's statements and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, yes. Particularly the government's work to prevent and respond to COVID-19. Whether or not it's the work that Minister Little is doing, for instance, on issues around commercial lease arrangements, or our announcement today from Minister Farfoy, which saw a $15 million investment in rural network capacity that will help lift the development and wellbeing of isolated communities as New Zealand's economy begins its recovery from COVID-19. As I said yesterday, we need to continue our collective approach in all areas to make sure we stay safe, that we save lives, but also livelihoods.
Will we come out of level three in a fortnight so tens of thousands more New Zealanders can get working again?
Mr Speaker, I can assure the member I am as eager as he is to see us return to normality as soon as possible. But what I'm also eager to do is make sure that we do not come out and then find ourselves yo-yoing back into restrictive measures at levels 3 and 4 again. That would be damaging for New Zealand's economy. It would be damaging for New Zealand's health. What we want to do is be considered, be clear and be confident. No one wants a second wave.
Why is it that so many tens of thousands of workers can't work under level 3 when they can demonstrate that they can do it safely?
Mr. Speaker, what we had to, of course, consider with the advice that we received from the Ministry of Health, from epidemiologists, from the technical advisory group, were measures that would make sure that in the short space of time we're in this waiting recovery room, that we can assess whether or not we've stamped out all of the embers of COVID-19. Now, until we have that assurance, we have to make sure we still limit people's contact as much as possible. We found balance. We wanted people to engage in retail, so we've asked that people do it without contact with each other. Because if, Mr. Speaker, we find those embers of COVID are still present, the last thing we will want is for someone, for instance, to have gone into back into opening up their shop, have had hundreds of customers coming through and contact with them, and then we have an exponential spread of COVID once more.
Does she think the 7,000 Kiwis going on job seeker support or the dole a week has peaked yet?
Mr. Speaker, I'm loath to make any predictions over what will happen with those accessing our benefit system presently. What I will say is that we have been very focused on trying to prevent that. The wage subsidy, which has cost collectively over $10 billion to date, has kept over 1 million Kiwis connected to their employer and to their work, and that is our goal. With those who are coming onto job seeker support, you will have seen yesterday the Minister for Social Development launching an initiative focused on connecting employers and potential workforce to try and get them into work as soon as possible. Despite the COVID environment, we still have job vacancies. In fact, I shared the example yesterday of those who had come from tourism moving into food production and processing. We now have some industries that previously relied on migrant labour, now with a much higher rate of domestic labour in those jobs. We need to keep up that job placement, and that is what we're focused on.
What does she estimate new unemployment growth weekly will peak at and when?
We have no such estimates. What we have had is Treasury running a range of scenarios and this wasn't specific to the drawing down of JobSeeker, but their scenarios talked about levels of unemployment. They range anywhere between 8.5% and well over that. That was the lowest rate they predicted. But of course, all of that is variable depending on how long we stay in restricted measures and also how much investment the government makes. And that is why we have invested.
What then do those scenarios tell us about what unemployment will hit when the 12-week wage subsidy ends?
Actually, Mr. Speaker, what it tells us is that we would do well to focus on getting out and staying out of restrictive measures, because that's one of the significant variables. The second is the amount of investment coming in from government, but I wouldn't limit that just to a wage subsidy. I think what we're all aware of is making sure that, yes, we keep people connected to their employer and to work, but also there will be some sectors that are gravely affected on an ongoing basis, so we will need ongoing specific and specially designed responses for those scenarios.
Does she accept that by staying at level three without the provision of more business support than is currently being provided, many tens of thousands more businesses than would otherwise be the case will go out of business, resulting in tens of thousands more on job seeker support?
As the member, I'm sure, will agree, we have acted quickly in being responsive to what we are seeing and hearing in real time from our small businesses in particular, but also the business community. And that is why, of course, we moved so quickly on the wage subsidy. It's why we've moved quickly on the two tax packages we've already put in place, which are multi-billion dollar packages. And it's also why, even, for instance, Mr. Speaker, today we've announced, even before final decisions have been made, Cabinet's intention to work up further options to embed our view that the burden for those in commercial leases needs to be as much as possible more evenly shared. And that's something that Minister Little is working on. And we flagged that even before that work has concluded.
Isn't it better to keep a business in business and its workers in work with government business support now than to see the business go to the wall and the workers go on the dole and government trying after the event to come up with new jobs?
Mr Speaker, that's exactly why we have the wage subsidy.
Does she accept we've had one of the most strict lockdowns on the one hand in the world, but the lowest levels of government business support again in the world, and what is she going to do about that?
Mr Speaker, no.
Why isn't the government providing more business support now, whether for rents or rates or other business costs?
Mr Speaker, again, I wouldn't trivialise the over $10 billion that has already gone into the wage subsidy. I equally wouldn't trivialise the support and guarantee that we've provided through the business finance guarantee. I also, Mr Speaker, point to the significant support provided through the two business tax packages. In total, over $5 billion worth of investment and support provided through those. And, Mr Speaker, as I've already said, we continue to work to be as responsive as we can to the different needs we're seeing arise, and that includes the forward signalling I've given today on the extra work we're doing on commercial leases.
Does she understand that waiting until Budget 2020 on May the 14th will be too late for many tens of thousands of businesses and many tens and thousands of workers?
Mr Speaker, I noticed the member in the House referring to Budget 2020 as a milestone for business support. I would like to correct him based on the evidence that we have rolled out packages all the way through to respond to need. It hasn't been a matter of waiting for Budget 2020. We will continue to announce initiatives to support businesses now. And Mr Speaker, regardless of what the member may believe, we're doing it based on what we hear, what we see and what we know.
Question number three, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Mr Speaker, my question to the Minister of Finance. Does he agree with the Right Honourable Winston Peters' statement yesterday, quote, all the rules on fiscal prudence are now obsolete?
Mr Speaker, I agree that in the face of a 1-in-100-year shock, every country around the world has to reassess its fiscal rules. Our budget responsibility rules foreshadowed this by saying that the rules would be met other than in the circumstance of a major global economic shock, which is clearly now occurring. The spending we have undertaken so far has been to support households and businesses through the shock, and we will continue to do that in a compassionate and responsible manner.
Point of order, Mr Speaker. I don't think he actually answer the question?
He certainly did.
Okay, all right.
He probably answered it and then said far too much afterwards.
Supplementary. Does he think this basic rule still applies, that money borrowed must eventually be paid back?
Mr Speaker, obviously when the government borrows money, it's fully aware of the fact of what might need to happen at the other end. And traditionally, over the last few governments, New Zealanders have done reasonably well in paying down the debt that has been built up in previous times. I would caution the member of going down this particular path of questioning, given the everyday occurrence of his party requesting that more money be spent. We are spending money in a compassionate and responsible way.
Does he think New Zealanders would be happy at the thought of Shane Jones operating without the rules of fiscal prudence operating?
Order. That's not an area the member has responsibility for. Supplementary question.
Has the Minister of Finance received any submission or representation from any finance spokesman around the world, let alone New Zealand, who doesn't understand that statement that the rules of fiscal prudence under COVID-19... and for the first time in a century, are now obsolete?
Mr Speaker, it would be clear from the comments of treasurers, ministers of finance, central banks, commentators like the Financial Times, not exactly harbingers of the socialist order, are all saying that now is a 1-in-100-year shock. It requires all governments around the world to reassess their rules. In New Zealand, we are making sure that we spend compassionately and responsibly.
Do you agree with the principle that money spent on poor quality projects or programs is money that can't be spent on useful programs or projects, or money that doesn't need to be added to the national debt?
Well, Mr. Speaker, in general, yes, I do, and I recall the flag referendum in that regard.
Much money has been spent on the COVID response so far. That is money out the door as opposed to money announced.
Mr. Speaker, $22 billion worth has been announced. Of that, we know that around $10.6 billion has gone out in the wage subsidy scheme. We also know that the money that was devoted to the increase in benefits has gone out the door. And I'm very pleased to announce that on May the 1st, on Friday, the doubling of the winter energy payment will commence.
Does he agree with Winston Peters that it makes sense to manufacture products in New Zealand if it could be made within 50% of the international price?
Mr. Speaker, I do believe...
a point of order, the
Mr.
right...
Mr. Speaker, if a member in a question seeks to use a quote, then he should be required to use it accurately. I never said 15%. I used Bill's figure of 15%.
Right. OK, it's now, I think the question, as adjusted by the right honourable gentleman, is now clear. The Minister of Finance can answer.
Mr. Speaker, I think it's incredibly important for New Zealand, in the face of this significant shock, to take stock of what we do and what we make in our country. We need to make sure as a country we continue to trade and get the lift in living standards that comes from that. But any government that does not take into account the significant disruption when it comes to what we manufacture in New Zealand would not be doing its job properly.
Why would we shift New Zealanders away from industries where we are international leaders to industries where we can't compete?
Mr. Speaker, I don't believe that's the intention of the government in any way, shape or form.
Question number four, Kieran McInaughey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Education, what steps has the government taken to ensure children and young people in early childhood education in schools can continue to learn from home while COVID-19 containment and elimination measures remain in place?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, I'm very pleased to say that the education sector has been rising to the challenge of COVID-19. The Ministry of Education worked with schools and early learning services to quickly assess the need for additional technological support, including additional modems, internet connections and devices. The Ministry of Education ordered routers, modems and devices insofar as the market is able to deliver them. We do have a supply constraint there. We work with telecommunications providers to remove data caps for up to 6 months so that households can access the broadband connectivity to stream content. As of Friday the 24th of April, we have sent out 170,000 hard packs of materials, that's printed materials and other equipment students need to learn from home. And of course we have got two learn from home TV channels up and running, one in English and one in Te Reo Māori.
Very good. Supplementary. How many devices, modems and hard packs has the government delivered to New Zealand homes to date while in level 4 and now level 3?
Mr. Speaker, around 149,000 and a half, or 149,500 of the hard packs of materials were distributed during the Level 4 lockdown. Further distribution has continued this week so that we're now up to that 170,000 plus figure. Overall, 10,900 packs have been distributed to early learning, 120,000 packs for students studying in years 1 to 10. We have 6,391 packs so far distributed to those studying for NCEA. That number is the one that has taken the longest to grow, and it is now increasing much more rapidly. Around 32,500 of the packs that have been sent out are in Māori language, Māori medium. And in terms of devices, 5,338 devices have been distributed by the Ministry of Education. That's on top of the roughly 12,000 devices that have been distributed by schools. 7,595 modems have been distributed, and our efforts to get that technology out to people continues.
Supplementary. How many people have tuned into the home learning television channels?
Mr. Speaker, it would be fair to say that I've been heartened by the number of people who have been watching the Home Learning Channel. It's good to see familiar faces, Susie Cato, Jason Gunn, Michelle Dickinson, among others, fronting TV shows. No, there are no plans to bring back play school. Mr Speaker, I am pleased to say that last Thursday, so overall we've had about 1 million people tuning into the Learning From Home TV channels. Last Thursday, we had 150,000 New Zealand viewers tune into the TVNZ Home Learning Channel, but a further 7,000 watched it via live stream, and of course more people are also watching it using the on-demand platforms.
Supplementary. What support is being provided to assist schools to set up and make the best use of distance learning?
Mr Speaker, it is an enormous challenge to get the entire education system working on a distance learning platform in such a short space of time. Around 800, or around a third of schools in Kura, have been accessing professional learning and development for online learning so that they can sharpen up their skills around that. We've established the Connected Learning Service, which has got a help desk and also provides additional support to teachers as they set themselves up for online learning. And alongside this support for teachers, supporting teachers with online learning resources, and advice is being made available in both English medium and Māori medium learning from home websites.
Question number 5, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health. What percentage of COVID-19 close contacts identified between 18 April and 24 April were successfully contacted, and how many of those contacts were made within 3 days?
The Honourable Dr David Clark.
Mr Speaker, the latest national data available for cases notified is for the period 18 to 20 April. For this period, 100% of close contacts were followed up within 3 days. National data collected from all PHUs requires manual collation from a number of sources. Therefore, there is a time lag between activity and reporting. The close contact data for probable and confirmed cases notified 21 to 27 April will be available in coming days.
If the gold standard for close contacts is so important, why is it not possible for the Minister of Health to advise this House a more recent data on performance?
Mr Speaker, I would note that the 100% record is quite impressive. The data that we are getting through shows that the primary health care follow-up from the public health units is indeed meeting the standards that we would hope to be gold standard treatment. The challenge that we have currently is that people are not necessarily coming forward soon enough for testing once they have symptoms. And so I would encourage the public to come forward and get tested because that is so important to our COVID effort.
When he said that 100% of close contacts between 18 and 20 April were followed up, does followed up mean successfully contacted?
That is what I have been advised by the Ministry of Health.
Have the situation reports from the Ministry of Health to him that have been released to my office had information removed from them prior to release?
Mr Speaker, and not that I'm aware of. I would assume that if the member's talking about the situation reports, they go out quite widely. Unless there was commercial information or any other very specific reason, I would expect that the member would receive those reports in their entirety.
Why then do those situation reports not contain the very information that he claims is so important to continue suppression of the virus?
I think the member's aware that historically that information was not centrally collected. We as a government have put in place a system that no government before has put in place. And we have gone from a situation where there was only local level activity to one where the government has put $70 million into public health and contact tracing. We've seen the National Close Contact Service established with a staff of more than 200, a new national IT solution set up, and we're adding surge response to increase staffing in our public health units by up to 300 full-time equivalent staff. That represents a huge scaling up of our public health capacity, and I want to thank all of those working at the front line for making this possible.
In respect of that IT solution, Can he confirm that all 12 public health units are using the National Electronic Platform for contact tracing?
Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that the intention is for all of them to use it. I can find out for the member whether they are all on the system. If he wants to put a question down in writing, I can get back to him on that.
Question number 6, the Honourable Nikki Kaye.
Mr. Speaker, question to the Minister of Education. Is he confident that schools and early childcare education providers have adequate support to ensure they are safe and feel supported to address the impact of COVID-19?
It's not quite what the question said, but... Right, there we go.
Mr. Speaker, yes, although as with any system that has been implemented rapidly and at large scale, there's always room for improvement, and we continue to identify improvements and make them where we can. The Ministry of Education has been sending out nearly daily special bulletins to early childhood education providers, home-based providers and schools and staff, with supporting guidance and information to help them reopen and put in place public health measures. We know that some early childhood services wish to change their operating hours during level 3 depending on the needs of their community. We also know that some have decided not to open because for physical attendance for a variety of different reasons. The government understands and has taken a very compassionate approach, which will not affect the education funding during this time.
Supplementary question. So does he accept that there are a proportion of early learning centres, but also potentially schools that have low attendance because they have some unanswered questions around safety?
Speaker, the government's guidance has been very clear that the people who should be making decisions about whether children are attending school or early learning services are their parents.
Supplementary question. What does he see are the criteria for full nationwide opening of schools in ECE, and does he believe that parents and educators should know before May 11th?
Mr. Speaker, broad guidance for the shift from level 3 to level alert level 3 to alert level 2, when that should happen, has already been published, and work is underway now with sector leaders to provide further detail on the shift from level 3 to level 2, as we did when we shifted from level 4 to level 3. And we'll continue to refine those guidelines based on the feedback that we get from people working in the sector, and we'll continue to do that, you know, run through that same process for an eventual shift from level 2 to level 1.
Supplementary question. In light of his answer yesterday that questions about the analysis of schools impacted by COVID-19 incidents should be directed to the Minister of Health, can he confirm that he's had no briefings or asked any questions on these schools?
Mr. Speaker, with regard to I listened to the question, the answer delivered on my behalf yesterday, and I don't believe that's an accurate reflection of what the Associate Minister said on my behalf. I believe the member's question referred specifically to a case relating to a school and the public health contact tracing measures that were put in place, and that is appropriately a question for public health officials. Both myself and the Ministry of Education have been keeping in contact with public health officials to ensure that the guidance that we're supplying to schools and early learning services is based on the very best information possible.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Supplementary to the Minister, can he confirm that the Director General of Health today spoke publicly about the Ministry of Health's intention to look more closely and undertake some research and analysis around the Maris cluster specifically, given that one of the more recent confirmed cases was actually someone who has exhibited the symptoms of COVID-19 for a long period of time, and that will teach us something about transmission between teachers, young people and staff, and will be used as a basis of evidence and a body of information for the Ministry?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I can confirm that. One of the clear pieces of guidance that has been supplied to the education sector already is that anybody exhibiting any symptoms at all should stay home and should get tested. One of the issues here was that people who exhibited mild symptoms didn't necessarily follow that guidance, and therefore it is that particular cluster has dragged on longer than it might otherwise have.
Supplementary question. With regard to the Prime Minister's statements, does he accept that the criticism that potentially the government has been slow on the analysis of those schools that had COVID-19 incidents?
Mr. Speaker, no.
Question
Question number 7, the Honourable Tracy Martin.
Mr Speaker, a question to the Minister for Regional Economic Development. What role is the Provincial Growth Fund intended to play in the government's economic response to COVID-19?
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
On behalf of the Minister, if there's any good in a crisis, is that it shines a light on what is a good idea or not. And COVID-19 has demonstrated that the PGF fund, its intent to build and expand infrastructure, to expand development, to create real jobs and real wealth and exports, has been confirmed as a brilliant idea. Now, the Provincial Growth Fund's success so far, with over 470 projects across our regions supported, including in the electorate of the members screaming out there, wantonly not knowing what's going on in their own electorate. Our regions supported means our regions are now better placed to deal with economic adversity, such as the nation's serenity, such as our nation currently faces. Can I also say, the brilliance of this idea is confirmed by the number of people barging their way from the National Party in terms of the electorate constituencies to be represented at every announcement, whilst coming down here and pouring cold water on that brilliance.
Honourable Tracy Martin.
Will the Provincial Growth Fund be engaging with the regions about the repurposing of the fund and those regions' post-COVID-19 priorities?
A brilliant question. On behalf of the Minister, most certainly. Top-down, Wellington-led processes have never served the regions well. The PGF has always prioritised engagement with those in the regions, as they know best what makes this economy tick. Not people who from Epsom who never ran a business in their life, have never even run the school tuck shop, and in front here as some sort of economic expert. How paradoxically stupid is that? There will need to be tough decisions made as the new reality we're faced, which means some projects are no longer viable, particularly in areas such as tourism. But these decisions will be made together with those affected, not dictated by some distant bureaucracy or some outdated neoliberal stupidity.
Supplementary. To the Minister, how has the Provincial Growth Fund supported regions to deal with crises like COVID-19?
Through the establishment of the PGF, there's now the framework and relationships in place for central government and the regions to work together to boost prosperity. The PGF has also provided the impetus for those in our regions to collaborate. When a member says, what bull, I'm asking to find one district councillor, one mayor in any part of the provinces of this country that's not supporting the fund. That's my evidence, not somebody parked up in Epsom who knows nothing about business and never will, because he's never been engaged in business. Yeah, both of those members have a similarity. They're cloned in terms of their inexperience. I want to say the PGF has provided the impetus for those in our regions to collaborate, identify obstacles to greater productivity, and in doing so, improve the lives of their people. And can I say something? Out there in the provinces, there are people who have got hope for the first time, because they know that their place in our society is as important as central Wellington or central Auckland or, dare I say it, Epsom, that exports very little and relies on the rest of the provinces to keep them alive.
To the Minister, what can New Zealanders do to help the regions as we begin the post-COVID-19 recovery?
On behalf of the Minister, our regions have fantastic people, products and services.
Name five.
Well, Southland, for example, has about... Excuse me. Five people. Oh, I thought you wanted to know five provinces.
Order. Order. Member, resume his seat. It has got to the point of getting a bit noisy and a bit silly. I think the Minister acting to the Minister of Regional Development was accurately answering an interjection, and it gets a bit unreasonable when he's then screamed down for doing it. So if people don't want their interjections answered, then they shouldn't make them.
Our regions have fantastic people, products and services.
Right now, we can only access those in a limited way due to the lockdown. But it's great to see people taking initiative during this time to highlight high-quality New Zealand-made products on social media. And dare I say it, out in the provinces, when you've got to close down, for example, in tourism, there are alternative employment streams beginning to open, and we are super supporting those. The difference, Mr. Bridges, of course, is that there are members of the National Party who every day get up in the morning and say thank God for New Zealand First in the Provincial Growth Fund, because they're getting nothing from the National Party at this point in time. And five, I can name half the caucus.
Question number eight, Dr. Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Health, does he stand by all his statements and actions regarding the coronavirus outbreak?
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Mr. Speaker, in their full context, yes, except for those actions taken in a personal capacity for which I have already apologised to New Zealanders. In particular, I stand by the decision to go hard and go early to combat COVID-19, which, thanks to the support and sacrifice of New Zealanders, has seen us manage to stop community transmission and eliminate the unknown spread of the virus for now.
Supplementary. Does he stand by his statement that the coronavirus response has been textbook, given the Epidemic Response Committee heard from community in-home providers that vulnerable people have refused care because the provider did not have PPE?
Mr. Speaker, I would say that we have moved to nationalise the distribution of PPE. Previously, that was provided by the private providers that did the service. They were responsible for their own health and safety plans and for securing their own PPE. When this became a challenge, the government has moved to set up a national distribution service, which is new, and I have requested a rapid stock take to ensure that PPE is getting to where it needs to go.
Tree. Prior to the National Distribution Service, was the PPE management, textbook?
Mr. Speaker, I think it's very evident to people that while by and large things have worked as they have intended to the whole way through, that setting up a new system, if you read any textbook, is liable to have a few challenges in it. And we have heard certainly anecdotes of PPE in the early stages not getting to where it needed to go. That's why I'm seeking the reassurance, since we have stepped in, to make sure that the system is working as it should.
Supplementary. Can GPs expect any further financial support from the government? And if so, what date can they expect to receive this?
Mr. Speaker, what I can tell the member is the government has already put $45 million into primary care as a part of our COVID response. Health officials are continuing to look at what further support might be appropriate to assist health and disability providers to meet the costs of preparing for COVID-19.
Supplementary. On what infectious...
The peer review. Start again, Dr. Retty.
Supplementary. On what infectious disease basis were cruise ship passengers who disembarked after self-isolation was compulsory at airports allowed to disembark at ports such as Auckland without self-isolation? On what infectious disease basis?
Mr. Speaker, if the member has specific examples or that he wishes to bring to me, I will happily consider them. I suspect he's referring to the earlier stages of the pandemic response. I think what we've seen with everybody in their bubbles over the recent period is that we now have the transmission rate of the virus down to below half a person per case. It has been a very successful response. Very happy to answer specific questions from the member if he wants to put them in writing.
Question number nine, the Honourable Todd McLean.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Small Business, what official estimates has he received, if any, of small business failure as a result of the Level 3 and Level 4 restrictions?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
On behalf of the Minister, I refer the Honourable Member to my answer to the primary question yesterday, the same question. This answer has been reconfirmed with MB today.
Supplementary. Does he stand by his statement to the Epidemic Response Committee on the 1st of April that wages... Sorry, if I may start again, Mr. Speaker. Does he stand by the statement of the Minister of Finance
to the Epidemic Response Committee on the 1st of April that, I quote, wages are the biggest expense that most businesses have, but second only to that is rent. We're working with small business sector on the shape of a package to deal with that, end quote. And if so, why are small businesses and landlords still waiting for government support more than 4 weeks later?
Mr. Speaker, I always agree with the Minister of Finance. I find that to be a particularly important part of my role. Following on from that statement, there was an announcement of a package of initiatives, including the $3.1 billion loss carryback scheme. And as to the second part of that statement, yes, indeed, we do continue to work with small businesses on what other support we can provide.
Does he agree with the Rotorua small business owner, Reg Hennessy, who said yesterday in the committee, and I quote, "We are all in this together. It doesn't matter whether it's landlords or us as business operators. We need something to work for both the landlord and the tenant together," end quote. And if so, when will the government do something to fix the growing commercial rent problem faced by small businesses and landlords?
Mr. Speaker, as the Prime Minister said earlier today and Mr. Little said in the House yesterday, that work is actively underway.
Does he accept that many more small businesses will fall over if the government fails to announce a substantial commercial rent and cash flow relief package soon?
Mr. Speaker, we're working every single day with small businesses and their representatives to ensure that as many of them as possible are able to continue to operate. I absolutely recognise for those SMEs who haven't been able to open back up under Level 3 that there is a significant amount of stress and concern. That's why we've put in place the initiatives we have, in particular the 12-week wage subsidy scheme that was paid upfront to allow businesses to be able to take some time to plan. And as I've said in all of my answers on the question today and yesterday, we continue to work with small businesses on what other support we can provide.
Why has the government given $50 million in addition to the wage subsidy in relief for the media, but not delivered any specific direct financial assistance for small businesses or landlords?
Mr. Speaker, the support package announced by Minister Farfoy for the media was an important element in making sure we continue to have a range of voices within our media. I think the member would recognise that that's important for our democracy to have those voices available. It's not mutually exclusive. In the meantime, there have been significant packages announced that benefit small businesses.
Question number 10, Greg O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health. How has New Zealand ramped up its testing for COVID-19 and what is the current daily capacity?
Mr. Speaker, testing is one of the key health measures we can take to stamp out COVID-19. New Zealand began testing on January 31st and has steadily increased capacity ever since. We've now 12 labs conducting tests and have completed more than 128,000 tests. Our daily testing capacity stands at more than 8,400. Mr. Speaker, New Zealand has developed a world-class testing regime, and I encourage anyone who has COVID-19 symptoms to seek medical advice and get tested.
Supplementary question. What progress has been made in testing for Māori and Pacifica people for COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, it's important that we test as broadly as possible. We want to see testing in all communities and across all ethnic groups. The most recent data I have available shows that Māori make up 16.1% of those tested. For Pacific peoples, the number is 8.2%. Mr. Speaker, those numbers are important and encouraging because we know that Māori and Pacific people have some of the poorest health outcomes in New Zealand.
Further supplementary, how does New Zealand's rate of testing compare internationally?
Mr. Speaker, New Zealand has now tested 23 people per 1,000 of population. That puts us comfortably in the top ranks internationally. For example, I'm advised that in the UK, 7 people per 1,000 have been tested. In South Korea, that number is 11, and it is 14 in Singapore. Germany, which has been widely praised for its testing, has tested 25 people per 1,000. Mr. Speaker, the volume of tests being conducted in New Zealand and the low rate of positive results shows our approach to COVID-19 is working, and we need to hold the course.
Question number 11, Stuart Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Transport. Can he confirm the reported statement he made to Sounds Air Managing Director Andrew Crawford on March 18 that, quote, We're not going to let you guys down. We're going to support the rural networks. You're a key part of the infrastructure of this country, end quote. And if yes, what has he done to deliver on these commitments?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Transport, yes. And as part of our $600 million aviation support package, the government's already provided support to airlines to fund air freight on the rural networks, including Air Chatham's, Barrier Air, Fly My Sky, Island Air Charters and Air Napier. While these measures directly support airlines, remote communities and exporters, we've also stepped in to fund things like air traffic control and security screening, things the aviation industry would normally pay for themselves. We've also halted any increases to fees. The Ministry of Transport is continuing to work with Sounds Air about what a package would look like for them.
Supplementary. Why has there been no progress and minimal discussion with Sounds Air over 6 weeks since he made that statement of support?
I'm going to ask the member to just to rephrase it, to take out, take the assertion out.
Why has there been no progress and minimal discussion with Sounds Air over 6 weeks since he had assured support for Sounds Air?
Okay, well, I'll add a reported in there and then it's probably okay.
The Speaker, I disagree with the assertion in the member's question. I can say that the Ministry met with Sounds Air on the 24th of March. They supplied further information in the middle of April. Sounds Air provided the Ministry further information in the middle of April. The Ministry requested further information from them. They had a further discussion with Sounds Air on the 20th of April. Further information was provided by Sounds Air from that date. On the 23rd of April, Sounds Air supplied more information to the Ministry. The Ministry met with them on the 23rd of April, and they've had further contact on the 28th of April.
Is it fair for the government to provide $900 million of financial support for Air New Zealand within 1 week, but to leave regional airlines like Sounds Air teetering on the brink of receivership?
Mr Speaker, I reject the premise in the member's question. Sounds Air have already benefited from the wage subsidy, as many other businesses up and down the country have benefited from that. And discussions between Sounds Air and the Ministry are continuing around what an additional support package for them might look like.
Will the Minister guarantee continuity of air services to the capital for the community solely dependent on Sounds Air of Blenheim, Taupo, Picton and Westport?
Mr Speaker, I can guarantee them that the Ministry will continue to talk with Sounds Air around what a support package for them will look like.
I'm just going to look at Ms Kerrigan. I thought your questions are finished. Do you agree with me? Yep, okay. Question number 12, Kerutapu Allen.
Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Commerce and Consumer Affairs. What changes to commerce regulation has the government made in response to COVID-19?
Mr Speaker.
Honourable Chris Farfoy.
Mr Speaker, our government recognises the severe impact of COVID-19 on businesses and consumers, and we've moved quickly to ensure that regulation can support both the response and recovery. In particular, we've provided a temporary exemption from parts of the Credit Contracts and Consumer Finance Act to support the Bank Mortgage Deferral Scheme, which will give consumers and businesses much-needed flexibility with their mortgages. We've also issued a GPS on essential goods and services to enable businesses to work collaboratively to maintain confidence in supply chains to get household supplies to consumers during the COVID-19 lockdown. We've also pushed out the implementation of new regulations to give businesses and institutions more time to both respond to the effects of COVID and adjust to new regimes. And we're also making changes to the Companies Act and other corporate governance legislation to provide relief for businesses from potential insolvency and some reporting requirements. All of these measures are designed to help businesses facing difficulties due to COVID-19 to remain viable and to keep New Zealanders in jobs.
Soon. How is the government supporting companies that are facing insolvency because of COVID-19?
Speaker, we are implementing a number of measures, and these include giving directors of companies facing significant liquidity problems because of COVID-19 a temporary safe harbour from insolvency duties under the Companies Act. We're enabling businesses affected by COVID-19 to place existing debts into hibernation until they're able to start trading normally again. We're also giving the Registrar of Companies the power to temporarily extend deadlines imposed on companies, incorporated societies, charitable trusts and other entities under legislation. And we're also giving temporary relief for entities that are unable to comply with requirements in their constitutions or rules because of COVID-19.
Supplementary, sir. Why did the government issue a policy statement on commercial cooperation during COVID-19?
Mr Speaker, Level 4 required flexibility in how businesses worked together, shared resources or took cooperative measures with other businesses under Level 4. The policy statement was issued to make sure businesses can work together in ways that allow them to provide things like food and other grocery products and other essential goods and services that New Zealanders needed in a fair and equitable way. The government recognised that going into Alert Level 4, that was not the time for strict competition rules to get in the way of the common good of making sure New Zealanders got access to essential items that they needed. We also made it clear that this did not mean that COVID-19 could be used as an excuse for non-essential collaboration or anti-competitive business practices such as price fixing.
And what other changes has the government made to protect business and consumers during COVID-19?
Mr Speaker, we were aware that in a minority of cases, some retailers or businesses were taking advantage of COVID-19 to inflate the prices they were charging for essential goods. That is why we set up the pricewatch@mb.govt.nz email address to give people a simple and effective tool to report any instances of price gouging. This tool proved highly successful, with over 3,500 emails being received and investigated by officials. In many cases, MB officials contacted retailers directly, and in many of those cases resulted in prices being lowered. When genuine instances of price gouging are identified, referrals will be made to the Commerce Commission to deal with under the Fair Trading Act.
That concludes oral questions.